Welcome to Think on CJSR FM 88.5. My name is Chris Roth. Think is a weekly spoken word program that you'll hear on CJSR every Thursday from 11 a.m. to noon. CJSR's Think presents lectures, panel discussions, and interviews with noteworthy individuals about some of the most crucial issues facing the world today. This week, the renowned Amy Goodman talks about the revolution of media and the growing popularity of corporate-free radio. Amy Goodman is the 1993 winner of the Robert F. Kennedy Prize for International Reporting, as well as the 1998 George Polk Award. A respected career as an investigative journalist led to the creation of her most notable achievement, Democracy Now! Goodman had been the news director of Pacifico Radio, WBAI, in New York City for over a decade before she co-founded the remarkable series Democracy Now!, which has been called one of the most significant progressive news institutions of our time. In this 2004 presentation at the NCRA Radio Conference, Goodman discusses the outrageous human rights violations committed in Iraq during the Iraq War. She breaks down the failures of mass media, explaining how America has become a nation of soundbites, and justifying the importance of independent radio. The media has evolved over the last 30 years. Once a respected faculty that held a place in every home, the selling out of corporate media has turned news into a regurgitative propaganda machine. The focus of marketing the news to increase corporate profits has overwhelmed mass media and created a subgroup of independent news sources, whose focus is informing the public of stories and issues that corporate media neglects. Democracy Now! Has led the way in creation of independent news reports, which have revolutionized modern media. Here is Amy Goodman on the importance of independent media.
Democracy Now! Is a daily, grassroots, unembedded, independent, international news hour. The growth in this show is astounding. 2 to 3 stations are picking us up a week, and I think that is a testament to the hunger now for independent media and voices. Not finding weapons of mass destruction in Iraq exposes more than the Bush administration. It exposes a media that acted as a conveyor belt for the lies of the administration, and people across the political spectrum are looking for some truth and honesty in media, a media that is independent from the government. We come from Pacifica Radio, founded by a man named Lou Hill, who was a conscientious objector in World War II. He refused to fight. When he came out of the detention camps, he said there has to be a media outlet that is run not by corporations that profit from war, but run by journalists and artists. That's how Pacifica was born. Not run by corporations, as George Gerbner, a professor of communications at the University of Pennsylvania, says, not run by corporations that have nothing to tell and everything to sell, that are raising our children today. And so the first Pacifica station, KPFA, went on the air in 1949. In the United States, FM was in its infancy, and they started to give out FM radios so people could hear the station. And as soon as they started doing that and they tuned into KPFA, they were asking for money. But that's really a profound point, that Pacifica pioneered the idea of listener sponsorship, that we wouldn't turn to the corporations, that we would turn to the listeners, beholden to no one but the listeners, the people who are producing the radio and are listening to the radio. That was KPFA, the first station. Then KPFK in Los Angeles, 1959, 1960. WBAI, where I come from, 1960, it went on the air. WPFW in Washington, D.C., 1977. KPFT in Houston, this is the 5 Pacifica stations, went on the air in 1970. It is the only radio station in the United States, I'm not sure if you have any here, whose transmitter was blown up by the Ku Klux Klan in the first year of operation, actually blown up twice. And when the Exalted Cyclops or the Grand Dragon, I confuse their titles, went on trial, he said it was his proudest act because he understood how dangerous Pacifica Radio is. Dangerous because it provides a forum for people to speak for themselves. And when you hear someone speaking from their own experience, that breaks down stereotypes and caricatures that fuel the bigotry that feed these groups. We all now know about the prison torture scandal that is going on in Iraq right now. And it's not just at the Abu Ghraib prison. There are dozens of detention centers. A young man named Camilo Mejia, who is Nicaraguan, Dominican, American, worked in the Florida Army National Guard, went to Iraq, came back on leave, refused to go back. In his CO application, his conscientious objector application, he said he had witnessed torture, not at Abu Ghraib, but at other detention facilities. He didn't want to return to be a part of that, but he offered to testify before the U.S. Congress. Instead, they court-martialed him and sentenced him to a year in prison. His father is a great Sandinista musician and composer, Mejia Godoy. And now his son will be in prison. If we lived in a just society, who would be behind bars and who would be free? But that prison torture scandal did not begin with the first low-level soldier laying a hand on the first Iraqi prisoner. It began right here at home. Somehow these soldiers believed that they had permission to do this. Now, I'm not exactly talking about the chain of command, because it's been documented now that it goes right up to the top. Donald Rumsfeld and George Bush, Cy Hirsch, Seymour Hirsch, the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter who won the Pulitzer for exposing the My Lai massacre in Vietnam, has been doing a series of remarkable pieces in the New Yorker magazine, one called Chain of Command, that shows that, you know, the higher-ups knew and condoned the general that's been sent from Guantanamo to run the Abu Ghraib prisoner. General Miller was the one who recommended that dogs be used, and we know the pictures now, the picture of the Iraqi prisoner who's cowering naked, and you see the hungry dog moving in, and the next picture is him on the ground having been bitten. But it didn't start with that first low-level soldier. They believe that they have permission. Why? I believe because the media acts as a megaphone for those in power, and when you have an administration that demonizes whole populations in the United States, and they don't have a chance then to speak for themselves, this is what somehow allows people to believe that they are less than human. This is why we need independent media. The average soundbite in the United States is something like 8-9 seconds. What can you say in that amount of time? You can say Saddam Hussein is Hitler, and you give great soundbite. You are ready for prime time, and everyone understands what you said. But if you have something else to say, like, U.S. administration officials have committed war crimes, that fits in to the 8 seconds, but people will think you're crazy. What are you talking about? You have to explain what you mean by war crimes. You have to explain international law and the laws that apply right in the United States. But that would take more time. The only thing that 8 or 9 seconds allows for is the repetition of the establishment consensus. If you want to go out of the box and say something else, you need more time. And so the soundbite itself is very political. And then, if you have a whole population in our country, Arabs, Arab Americans, Muslims, people of South Asian descent, Pakistanis in particular, if you want to hear what they have to say describing their own experiences, what it means to live in the United States in this post-9/11 climate, just today, our newscast on Democracy Now, talking about the latest memo out of the Department of Homeland Security, talking about going after and looking at every Pakistani who comes into the airport, any airport in the United States, looking at them for rope burns or other signs that they might be training at terror camps. Can you imagine what's going to happen to people of South Asian descent, even more so at the airports today? But if we don't have a forum where we can hear them describing their own experience, that they are human, then soldiers who go to Iraq somehow think that these people must be dealt with. They are not like us. That's why independent media is so important. I mean, I think people are engaged at the grassroots level, but the corporate media simply doesn't give voice to those voices. I mean, in our country, in the United States, you have this small circle of pundits who know so little about so much, who are brought into... I used to wonder how they run from one network to another in the day, how they make it to every network. And now I've decided they sit in a small circle and they just change the logo behind them. NBC, CBS, ABC, CNN. No, we need to broaden the discussion. I wrote The Exception to the Rulers, Exposing Oily Politicians, War Profiteers, and the Media That Love Them with my brother, journalist David Goodman, who's a superb journalist, who's written extensively about Africa, lived in South Africa, Namibia, Zimbabwe, Sudan, Liberia, Sierra Leone, reports on women and children in conflict zones and child soldiers. His previous book was called Fault Lines, Journeys into the New South Africa. This is my first book and our first together. But in this, we have three chapters, crackdown, smackdown, lockdown. You get the idea. But in crackdown, a subtitle, Don't Take My Father. Nadine Young Olvey was in the shower in her Brooklyn apartment at 6:30 a.m. on November 8th, 2002, the day after Election Day in the United States, when she heard a crash at her door. Her seven-year-old daughter, Brittany, went to see what was happening. She was greeted by men who demanded to be let in. They'd broken down the front door to the apartment building. Nadine shouted to her daughter not to let them in, but the frightened girl screamed it was the police. Nadine leaped out of the shower and attempted to close the bathroom door while she put on clothes. The men had already stormed inside, ordered her to keep the bathroom door open while she dressed. They shouted for Nadine's three young children to go into the bedroom. Then they ordered Nadine's husband, Faisal, a salesman in a clothing store, to get out of bed. Faisal Olvey is a Pakistani taekwondo expert who traveled to the U.S. in 96 for a martial arts competition, then applied for political asylum. He failed to show up for his last asylum appointment that year and was ordered deported. But Faisal Olvey remained in the country. Like so many others, the undocumented immigrant scratched out a living. In April 2001, he married Nadine Young, a U.S. citizen. He helped raise Nadine's two children from a previous relationship, Devin and Brittany. In 2001, they had a child of their own named Shaheem. Faisal had never had trouble with the law, but now he was caught in the anti-terror dragnet, and so was his terrified family. They told my husband to get out of the bed and to go into the living room, Nadine told me on Democracy Now. I asked, what's the situation? What's going on? The officer replied, she said, we only address questions to him and you need to mind your own business, he told her. And I'm like, Nadine says, but you need to provide me with a search warrant or a warrant for his arrest. They told me no. That was their answer, she said. It set the tone for what was about to come. They asked Faisal to put up his fingerprints, Nadine said, to place against a piece of paper. After they asked him some questions, they told him, get dressed, we're taking you, you've got to go with us. My son said to the officer, don't take my father. I just gave Faisal a hug and kiss goodbye and told him, don't worry, I will fight this. And so on Sunday evening, November 17th, 9 days after being detained, Faisal called Nadine. They posted a handwritten letter next to my picture for me to pack up my stuff and get dressed, he told her. He feared correctly he was going to be deported. Nadine immediately contacted the director of a project that advocates for rights of Pakistani immigrants, who called an attorney named Elizabeth Ouyang. Bobby Khan, who was with the Coney Island Avenue Project, had no time to drop his wife and two-year-old daughter off, so he picked up Ouyang and they all rushed to Faisal's jail. On the way, Nadine called Bobby's cell phone to say she was coming too. Ouyang said there was no guarantee that Nadine would see Faisal. Nadine replied, I don't care, he's my husband, I need to be there. It was pouring rain when they reached the jail. When I went in there, Liz Ouyang said, Faisal was in shackles and plain clothes and he was scared. Faisal told her, I don't know what's going on. They ordered us to put our civilian clothes on and to pack up. There are 22 of us back there that were ordered to do this. They won't tell us where we're going or what they're doing. Despite the shackles on his ankles, he kept pacing back and forth. Liz told Faisal, "Stay calm. We'll try to do everything we can." And Li Zuyang came out, the lawyer. Nadine arrived at the jail, his wife. She was not allowed to speak to her husband. Uyang wanted to ensure that the immigration authorities knew Faisal was married to an American citizen and was in the process of getting legal residency in the country, but she had another concern. "I've been told, I've heard stories, I've received emails that mass deportations are going on." The rumors came to life at 3:30 a.m. when a white bus pulled up to the detention center. Immigration and Naturalization Service was emblazoned on the side of the bus in large green letters. Li Zuyang rang back inside and demanded, "I want to talk to immigration. I want to know where they're taking Faisal." In the tense encounter that followed, a prison guard came out to warn the lawyer, Uyang. He said, "We won't talk to you. They've got orders to take him." She said, he added a threat, "If any of you follow, you will be arrested." Outside in the rain, Uyang calmed Nadine down as much as she could. Nadine wanted to follow the bus. Uyang reasoned with her, "If you get arrested, how will you help him?" So they each went home to work the phones. Nadine called the Pakistani consulate, her congressmember, and Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton. At 5 a.m., Liz Uyang reached an emergency deportation officer. She explained what had just transpired. She said, "I don't know where they're taking him. I need information, please," the attorney begged. At 7 a.m., a different deportation officer called back. The officer was taking Faisal to the airport. He said, "All I can tell you, he's on a flight at 11:30 this morning." Uyang said if she was able to get a stay, how could she reach him? That's when Uyang got a crucial piece of information, the officer's cell phone number. Only one option remained. Uyang rushed to the courthouse in New Jersey. As Bobby was driving her, she called ahead to the court clerk to alert her that an emergency stay of the deportation order was coming. Just as they were about to enter the Holland Tunnel in New York, the New Jersey court clerk told her that Faisal's file was in Manhattan. They turned the car around, headed to 26 Federal Plaza in Lower Manhattan. The original judge on Faisal's case was no longer there, so it was reassigned to another immigration judge. Meanwhile, the clock kept ticking. At 10:15, Judge Patricia Rohan approved the request for an emergency stay of deportation, agreeing to hold a hearing for Faisal at a later date. The lawyer said, "Judge Rohan breathed life into our Constitution's principle of due process. By the grace of God, we were able to get the judge to sign the emergency stay, but the drama was not over." After Judge Rohan signed the stay, Uyang announced, "Your Honor, I have nowhere to fax the order to. They're already at the airport. He's boarding." Uyang pleaded with the judge to call the deportation officer's cell phone. Meanwhile, she'd had to run downstairs to pay the $110 fee for the legal motion. When Uyang returned, the court clerk said the phone was busy. Uyang went outside the courtroom to call the officer. It was busy. Uyang then realized it was probably Nadine pleading for a final time with the officer to release her husband. She reached Nadine, told her to get off the phone. Then Bobby Khan's phone rang. It was the deportation officer asking who was trying to reach him. The lawyer grabbed the phone, started running to the courtroom. A court officer came out of nowhere and yelled, "No cell phones in the courtroom." Uyang just kept running, shouting, "It's for the judge." The officer followed in hot pursuit. Uyang burst into the courtroom, followed by the officer. The judge had already begun a new hearing, but upon seeing the attorney, she came off the bench, grabbed the phone, and she spoke into it. She said, "This is Judge Rohan, immigration judge, New York. I'm ordering you to take Faisal Olvi off the plane." Just before the plane doors slammed shut, agents took Faisal away. Dozens of other men were deported to Pakistan that day. Faisal Olvi was reunited with his family. He's now going through the normal immigration process to become a permanent resident of the United States. And today we had them on. That was a year ago, going through the process, trying to figure out if he would be taken away. Today was his court date. This morning, he came into Democracy Now! With Nadine and Li Zuyang. Nadine could not stop crying from the beginning of our interview to the end, absolutely terrified. If the judge ruled that he would be sent back to Pakistan and apply from Pakistan to come, which sounds neutral enough, it would have meant he couldn't have come here for at least 10 years. And so they pleaded for him to be granted the beginning of getting his green card in the United States. Well, the judge ruled today, I just got off the phone when we landed in Edmonton, that she not only was going to make sure that Faisal Ulvi got a green card, but instead of giving him a temporary green card, she said, given what he had been through for these last few years, she was giving him an immediate permanent green card. They will have a very happy Independence Day weekend. Unfortunately, while it is an incredible celebration for the Ulvi young family, so many thousands of people are still in detention in the United States. We don't know their names. On April 15th, on the exact hour of the anniversary of Pacifica Radio, we were in Berkeley, California, celebrating. It's one of the first places we went to on our exception to the Ruler's Book and Media Tour, as we go around the country celebrating media that is the exception to the Ruler's, community radio and community television. And I know you've been talking also about public TV, public access TV. I don't know if your system works the same way as we have in this country, but when a cable company comes into a town in the United States and they dig up the road, whether it's Comcast or Adelphia or Time Warner, many different companies, they get a monopoly because the community doesn't want the road to be dug up more than once. And in exchange, when media activists know, when community members know that they can demand of the cable company, and I suspect you have the same thing here, that they have to give back some public interest channels. It takes people knowing, and then you have TV where you can make your own media just like on radio, and it is so important that we have people instead of corporations in charge reflecting what is going on in the community. 3 o'clock was the time KPFA first went on the air in 1949. A young reporter from a local paper asked, what would I be doing at 3 o'clock? It was before our big event that night. Well, we were over at the Prison Radio Project in San Francisco waiting for a phone call. It came, and there was a tape recording I've come to know well, and then the familiar live words on a move. It was Mumia Abu-Jamal speaking to us from death row in Pennsylvania. He had 15 minutes before the line went dead. In that time, a tape recording came on several times warning, you're speaking to a prisoner. You can hang up if you want to. And he talked about conditions on death row. When he shares commentaries with us that we broadcast on Democracy Now! And Pacifica stations and community stations broadcast his commentaries, he doesn't talk about his own case. He talks about conditions on death row. It is so important when we are discussing issues of criminal justice in the United States. We have the largest prison population in the world, more than 2 million people. Thousands of people on death row, the only country in the industrialized world. When we are having these debates and discussions, we need to hear from people on both sides of the bars. We need to go to the death rows and hear from people there. We are not trying to win a popularity contest. We are journalists. Our job is to go to where the silence is, to give the microphone to people who are not usually heard. And so, on that day, April 15th, the next day we broadcast that interview. In 1997, when we first started running Mumia's commentaries nationally, we were pulled off of every station in Pennsylvania where Mumia Abu-Jamal is on death row. We were the most popular program on their public radio network, but it was owned by a university called Temple University. They ended their contract with Pacifica. They ended running Democracy Now! That morning because they said it was, quote, inappropriate to air the voice of Mumia Abu-Jamal. I think we have to fight that kind of censorship. We have to stand, and even mainstream media organizations like the National Society for Professional Journalists stand with us in this, that it is absolutely critical that we see ourselves outside of the government, that we be the fourth estate. In the United States, our profession, journalism, is the only one protected by the United States Constitution. the only one explicitly protected because we're supposed to be the check and balance on government.
You're listening to CJSR FM 88.5, Edmonton's alternative news source. Currently, you're listening to Found Bites, a collection of programs CJSR has recorded over the years and simply must be heard again. We are now going to continue with the second half of a lecture by the host of Democracy Now!, Amy Goodman, delivered at the University of Alberta's power plant in 2004. Democracy Now! Can be heard on CJSR Mondays at 5 p.m.
I told a story last year, I think, of the Sally Jesse Raphael show, didn't I? No? Well, it's a good one, because maybe you don't know her. Maybe that's not a bad thing. Do you know? Have you heard of that program in the United States? I hope they didn't export it here. But they did? You saw it in Canada? Uh-huh. Okay, then you'll appreciate this. We have a chapter in The Exception to the Rulers called Things Get Messy with Sally Jesse. And it's about the Persian Gulf War. What was happening then. At that time, 1991, CBS was owned by Westinghouse, NBC was owned by General Electric, two of the major nuclear weapons manufacturers owning two of the major U.S. networks, and those nuclear weapons manufacturers made most of the parts for most of the weapons in the Persian Gulf War. So you wonder why what we watched on TV looked like a military hardware show. CBS executives being quoted in the Wall Street Journal saying that the war coverage had to be more upbeat moving into commercials because it was hard to sell that toothpaste if there was some blood right before. Well, during this period, we were railing against the bombing of the cradle of civilization back to the cradle on the air. I was on WBAI. It was right after a newscast. And it was in the middle of fundraising drive. And a volunteer ran in, and, well, all of you are involved in your community radio stations, and you know that volunteers are the heart of community radio. And those listening on the radio, I hope that if you have fundraising drives at your station, that you come in and help answer phone calls and do what needs to be done. You are the lifeblood of all radio and all over community radio. So a young volunteer ran in and she said, "The Sally Jesse Raphael show is online." I said, "Yeah, right." And I just kept on the air. And she kept coming back. Even though volunteers are so critical, I just thought this one was hallucinating. But anyway, I picked up the phone to please her. And sure enough, there was a producer from the show. She said she was calling from her limousine. Well, I guess her chauffeur had turned on the program. But she said, would I come on the show in 2 days? They wanted to have a discussion about the war. And I said, sure. You know how that show is. You know, I was trying to think, well, what would I wear? Like, this is TV, right? I could dress as a man, dressed as a woman, masquerading as a man, pretending to be a woman, go whatever. But I figured out what to do, and I went over to this to the Sally Jesse Raphael studio, and they kept us in two green rooms, the women for the war and the women against the war. Three women for, three women against, and the other five women, three for and two against, other than myself, were all military, which was very interesting. And the producer came out and said, okay, now I don't want you to meet until you go out on the stage because I want you to really duke it out. I want it to be fireworks. Should I want the show to get the ratings that the other shows get to prove that we can discuss important issues and maintain that audience or even build it? Now, I actually thought that's not a bad idea. You know, I don't think it matters whether you work inside the system or outside the system. I think what matters is that you're able to make a difference where you are. And if you can, stay there no matter how painful, and just keep at it. And so we went out on the stage. The studio audience was there. The lights came on. The music came up. Sally came out, and the show began. She handed the microphone to someone in the audience, and the woman said, "I'm really concerned about Saddam Hussein's biological and chemical weapons." To which the woman next to me, the guest, Dr. Yolanda Hewitt Vaughn, responded, Dr. Yolanda Hewitt Vaughn was an Army captain trained as a doctor who said who was refusing to go to the Gulf, saying she was trained to save lives, not take them. And she said, I share your concern, but I think it's important to point out that we have biological and chemical weapons right here in the United States. But before she got out the word states, Sally whirled around. She came barreling down the aisle at such a velocity. And she was shouting, you be quiet, you shut up, or you get out. This is my show. And she is coming down so fast. And I was thinking of that woman, the producer, who said, we want you to duke it out. And I thought, oh, my God, I don't know if you've heard of Jerry Springer, but people actually do this. You know, oh, my God, I hadn't really watched the show. Is this what's expected? Oh, my. And you have to see Dr. Yolanda Hewitt Vaughn. She was very petite, wearing a long black dress, hair tied back, big glasses, hands in her lap, very soft-spoken. She looked almost Amish. And I guess I just felt protective. Sally is coming up, just about to come on the stage, and I said, whoa, Sally, back off. And then, of course, they had told us we should fill the audience, pack it, with our friends. So I brought people from BAI, and they were chanting, free speech, free speech. You can dress them up, but you can't take them anywhere. So anyway, Sally started to break down. Right in front of us, her producers came out. She had stopped the taping of the program. And they started to rock her back and forth, saying, that's okay, Sally, that's okay. It was the one moment of unity for us six women on the stage. We were just staring in shock at the spectacle. I mean, could you imagine if these few words had this kind of effect, as if she had never heard an anti-war point of view before, these words had this effect on this one person, if they actually seeped out just a couple more, a few more times around the country, I mean, it would rock the globe. Somehow, though, her producers convinced her to carry on with the taping of the show. Well, there would be one caveat. We would have to raise our hands if we had anything to say. I had never seen that before, except on Sesame Street, but we agreed. And so we carried on. And it was a really good show. Sally showed videotape of the protesters in Washington, and she asked me, who are these people? Now, I didn't know everyone's name, but I said, you know, these are people who are engaged in their what they believe is their patriotic duty. You know, they go out on the street because they're not invited into the corporate network studios. To have a civilized discussion one-on-one about why they oppose war. They're not invited in like people like Henry Kissinger, who was invited in so often. Yesterday I saw him on Charlie Ruse, the day before somewhere else. Henry Kissinger brought in to explain why he supports every invasion. No. They can only come out and hope that on a global warming day, if they are 10,000 or 100,000 strong, that a CBS executive might open his window and their chant of no war might waft in and hit an open microphone. That's their best bet. Anyway, that's the kind of discussion we had. And we went on, and I said, as the granddaughter of an Orthodox rabbi, I am horrified to see little Israeli children wearing gas masks. But I'm more horrified to see little Palestinian children without gas masks. And that's the kind of conversation that we had.
Welcome to Think. On this week's episode, investigative journalist and co-founder of Democracy Now!, Amy Goodman, discusses the rising popularity of independent news sources and the corruption of mass media.
My grandfather died years ago, but we've just celebrated my grandmother's 107th birthday. Some of you might have heard the program a few weeks ago when, I don't know if you know this guy, Willard Scott on NBC, the Today Show, but he wishes people who hit 100 a happy birthday, some of them, right? And he was wishing my grandmother a happy birthday a couple weeks ago, and it was happening during the broadcast of Democracy Now!, actually, and I had said to the director, could you put her on the plasma screen, the show, NBC, so I could at least see it, like this is historic and it's my grandmother. And then I thought, well, wait a second. Maybe when he wishes her the happy birthday, we can merge for a second. Now, don't get concerned. We're not merging with NBC. But just for that second. And I know they could sue us. You're not allowed to, you know, take someone else's program. But my God, it's my grandmother. So anyway, we decided to do this, right? And so it's going to happen halfway through the show at 8:35. And at the time, I was interviewing a professor from the University of Maryland. They just did the study that showed most people in the United States believe the U.S. found weapons of mass destruction, right? Now, that's not because Americans are stupid. It's because they are good media consumers. And they have been told by ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, not just Fox, all of the networks, as well as the paper of record, the New York Times, over and over again for more than a year, every single hour, that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. If they go away for a second to the bathroom or to get the newspaper or out for a walk, you miss the part where, you didn't find him. So it's not surprising, right? But anyway, that's what we were in the middle of the conversation. My God, it's about to be 8:35, and I see that the Today Show is going to the 100-year-olds. Like, they're about to wish. So I say, excuse me, professor, we have just one moment, some breaking news here. And I'm watching, but I don't want to join the whole thing. I didn't realize how many 100-year-old people there are, year-olds there are. But anyway, so they sort of go around in a circle. I hadn't seen this before. And they say, there's Wilma from Cleveland. She's at 100. And they're actually their photograph is in a Smucker's label. And so I thought, oh, my God, after all of these years, my grandmother is going to come around in her photograph. And I have kept her out of a jam my whole life. And here, so anyway, they're going 100, 100, 101, all the spring chickens. And they finally get to Sonia Bach, 107 years old. She's a musician. She played guitar in a guitar orchestra in Russia. And she knows 4.5 languages, he said. And then it went to Willard on some golf course in Florida, who said, I wonder what that half language is. Well, it is French. She has been studying French for over 100 years. So that was our little moment there. And then we came away from it. And now we'll go back to 91 and the Sally Jesse Raphael show. That was the end of the program, talking about war. And at the end of the show, the cameraman gave me the thumbs up. And we went back to BAI, and the show was going to be broadcast in 2 days. And 2 days came and went, and the show didn't air. And so I called the Sally Jesse Raphael show, and I said, hey, what's up? And the producer said, oh, there was a problem with the syncing of the sound in the video. We won't be able to use the program. I said, I started to get that syncing feeling. And I said, I think you had a problem with the sound of our voice. She said, oh, come on, we'll have you back someday. I said, oh, yeah, right. I said, you can't, because Dr. Yolanda Hewitt-Vaughn is going to jail. She was court-martialed, and she was sentenced to 3 years in prison. She lived right in the brig, right under death row, and her three young children being raised alone by her husband. And when I was on this Exception to the Rulers tour in St. Louis celebrating KDHX and DHTV a few weeks ago, I was signing books after the talk, and I wrote Dear, and I looked up at the young man, what should I write? And he said, Emiliano Hewitt-Vaughn. This was Dr. Yolanda Hewitt-Vaughn's older son. He was 8 at the time, and he is now grown up. When high school, he started the first Amnesty chapter, believing that maybe he could free someone else's mother, the way Amnesty International, who declared her a prisoner of conscience, did, because she was freed after 8 months instead of serving the full 3. But back to that conversation, I said, that we're not going to be able to do this. Dr. Yolanda Hewitt-Vaughn is going to jail. I said, how'd you find out about this technical problem? Remember the cameraman giving the thumbs up? He didn't seem very concerned. They said, Chicago and Minneapolis called, two places that aired the show, and they said the videotape was unusable. So I called those stations, asked for the operations director, said I was a concerned viewer. What happened to the Sally show on war? And they said, odd you should ask. We haven't aired it because they pulled it in New York. We're scrambling to get another show. So called back the Sally Jesse Raphael show and said, the jig is up. I would like to speak to the executive producer now. And they said, he's a very busy man. So people kept calling us at BAI. I said, don't call us. Call the Sally Jesse Raphael show. I don't know why they're not running it. And this is the power of media activism. Hundreds, if not thousands, of people called. I don't know. All I know is years later, I met a producer from that show who said that the calls that rained down on that program shut it down for 2 days. All I know is 2 days later, I got a call from a high-level producer at the Sally Jesse Raphael show who said the executive producer would like to speak to you now. I said, I'm a very... They asked if I would cry censorship if they edited the program. And I said, no, I'm an editor too. You have every right. As Sally very vociferously pointed out, it is her show. And I assume you'll edit out Sally's fit, which they did. And the show did air the next day, and it ran with headlines that said, things get messy with Sally Jesse. And the most interesting response I got was from women on southern military bases who called to say, we've never heard this view on television before, and we agree with you. I mean, here were women who were going to war, or their loved ones were, going to kill or be killed. I don't know which is worse. And they can't have these discussions on military bases. They rely on us in civilian society to have these critical discussions. And I see the media as a huge kitchen table that stretches across the continent that we all sit around and debate and discuss the most important issues of the day, life and death, war and peace, and anything less than that is a disservice to the servicemen and women of our country. Speaking of a small group of people making a difference, changing the world, some of you may have heard the Democracy Now! Coverage of what happened in the midst of the invasion and occupation of Iraq this last February in another hemisphere, right here in our own, what happened to the first black republic in the world, Haiti. You know, this year it's celebrating its bicentennial. 1804, it was first established, born of a slave uprising. In the United States, the Congress refused to recognize Haiti for decades, afraid that it might inspire slaves in the United States to rise up as well. And the U.S. has always held something against Haiti, the U.S. government. We know what happened 91 to 94 when the first democratically elected president of Haiti, Aristide, was thrown out, ousted in a three-year coup. The FRAP, backed by the U.S. intelligence agencies, CIA and DIA, and their leader, Emmanuel Constant, being responsible for the deaths of thousands of Haitians. Bush says he has this war on terror in the United States. Well, that terrorist, Emmanuel Constant, walks freely in New York. He should be in jail, but he has a lot of beans to spill if he is ever put in jail. But the number two man in FRAP, Jodel Chamblain, who is found guilty of the murder of the justice minister in 1993, Guy Mallory. His picture appeared on the front page of the New York Times, Guy Mallory lying in his own blood. And a few weeks before that, the death of Antoine Ismery, a Haitian businessman whose home I stayed at, who had thrown in his lot with Lavalasse, with Aristide's party. And on September 11th, 1993, yes, there have been other September 11ths around the world, Antoine Ismery was in a procession with others, remembering a massacre that had taken place 5 years before in 88, when Jean-Bertrand Aristide, before he became president, a fiery preacher at the Saint-Jean Bosco Church in Port-au-Prince, thugs moved in, massacred the congregants. That was September 11th, 88. September 11th, 93, the commemoration procession. Antoine Ismery was forced to his knees behind a church, and in broad daylight and cold blood, he was executed. Jodel Chamblain found guilty of that murder. These are the people who are now responsible for the latest ouster of President Aristide, who once again was elected president. In the early hours of February 29th, he was ousted from the country. On March 1st, we got frantic calls from U.S. Congressmember Maxine Waters of Los Angeles and the founder of TransAfrica, Randall Robinson. They said, quick, go on the air. We have just heard from the Aristides. No one knew what had happened to them. They were his close personal friends. They had been talking to him and Mildred Aristide, his wife, the First Lady of Haiti, hourly in these very critical days when this group of thugs, very well armed, was moving in on the capital. And not, as the U.S. corporate media was saying, a popular uprising taking place. Nothing of the sort. This gang of thugs was moving in. And has to be further investigated who gave them these high-powered modern weapons. And they were making their way to the Capitol, and suddenly Robinson and Waters got a call from Aristide. He said he was in the Central African Republic, had been dumped there in a U.S. plane, that he was the victim of a modern kidnapping in the service of a coup d'etat backed by the United States. We went on the air. We do closed captioning on the TV broadcast so that 28 million Americans can have access to the program who are deaf and hard of hearing. And that's a wonderful thing about joining radio and television, because we can now make community radio accessible to those who cannot hear. And so because we do the closed captioning, we have those transcripts. We put them on our website at democracynow.org, and the corporate network reporters took those transcripts and took them to the White House, took them to the Pentagon, and challenged the Pentagon press conference, Donald Rumsfeld, and said, is it true what Pacifica's reporting, what Aristide is saying? And he said, that's ridiculous. But I've learned in my years as a reporter, when a politician says that's ridiculous, you're probably on the right track. And so 2 weeks later, Congressmember Maxine Waters, Randall Robinson, Sharon Hay Webster, a member of the Jamaican Parliament, and Aristide's lawyer, chartered a small plane and made their way to the Central African Republic to retrieve the Aristides. I was able to go on that oh-too-small plane as we traveled two-thirds of the way around the world. We went to Miami and then on to St. Thomas, to Dakar, Senegal, to Bangui, Central African Republic, and they negotiated with the dictator for 7 hours, Bizize, who had risen to power himself in a coup the year before. The U.S. really knows how to choose them. And somehow they managed to call the bluff of the most powerful country on earth, the United States, because they were challenging, saying, if he is not a prisoner, then he is a free man and he can choose where he wants to go. As they were negotiating, Aristide said to me, when he goes away and says he's considering what they have asked, he's actually going to get his marching orders from France and the United States. And ultimately, the Aristides were freed. And as we drove back to the airport, I had a satellite phone and I gave it to President Aristide, and he spoke, and we were able to broadcast, stream it out at democracynow.org, and we're filing reports almost every hour through this 48-hour period. And Associated Press was taking our reports and putting them out around the world. We flew back from Central African Republic, Dakar, Senegal, Cape Verde Islands, over the Atlantic, where President Aristide told the story. Said on the early morning hour of February 29th, the second man in the U.S. Embassy came to his home and told the Aristides they had to leave. They could be killed. Thousands of Haitians would die. And they thought that they were being taken as they requested to speak to the press. Instead, they were hustled onto a plane with U.S. military and security, not knowing where they were going. When Mildred Aristide picked up the shade, she was told to put it down, and they drove like that for almost 24 hours. They flew until they were dumped in the Central African Republic, a very remote area where there was one plane out a week, where it was very difficult to get phone service. Yes, the U.S. knew precisely what they were doing. But this small delegation of committed people did bring the Aristides home to this hemisphere. And as we flew over the Atlantic and landed in Barbados, we heard the warnings from Rumsfeld, Rice, and Powell that they were threatening the Aristides who are not to return to this hemisphere. And then they were brought to Jamaica because the Jamaican Prime Minister, P.J. Patterson, had said that they could come to Jamaica to decide their next move. And as we landed on the tarmac in Kingston, CNN called and asked for my report. And I said I'd like to bring on Congressmember Maxine Waters as well. The Aristides had already been taken off in a helicopter to another area of Jamaica. They said, no, it's too complicated for the host. He hardly understands what's going on. He was doing some kind of lifestyle show. Just talk quickly and explain what happened and make it simple. Actually, that's very good, because then you don't get the kind of political edit you might otherwise if they really don't know what's going on. And so they said, okay, you're on right now. And I describe what had happened, and he thought, I think it was a vacation segment or something. You know, here I was in Jamaica. And I just described quickly that the Aristides had been brought back. And he said, and you could tell now someone is starting to say things. And what about the violence, he said, because you know that the U.S. administration was saying that Aristide would be the one to cause the violence. And I said, I'm so glad you raised the issue of violence, because we need to understand who these people are who have taken over the country working with the United States, like Jodel Chamblain, number two man in FRAP that was supported by the intelligence agency set up 10 years ago in the first coup, like Jean Tatoune, who was responsible for the Rabateau massacre in 1994 that had killed so many Haitians. To understand who this core of people are and what their relationship is to the United States. And so we were able to get word out. And from CNN to the AP reports to those corporate network reporters taking Pacific reports to the Pentagon and White House, I call that trickle-up journalism. That is the power of independent media. Every time a book like this succeeds, it means that the publishers understand, where there's this proliferation of conservative imprints, that there is a market out there. They call it a market. We call it a citizenry and non-citizenry that is hungry for other voices. And it is an absolutely critical message that has to be sent. I do think, though, Michael Moore has managed to send this message very, very strongly. Shame on Disney for trying to prevent one of the most powerful media moguls in the world today, the whole Disney empire, for trying to stop Fahrenheit 9/11 from being distributed. You know, they owned the subsidiary Miramax and told them they couldn't distribute it. We all have to say no to that kind of censorship. And we have to support a media environment that breaks up these media monopolies so that when a Disney says no, it has the kind of effect it does. We need a media that is regulated to serve the public interest. It is our airwaves, whether in Canada or the United States, they are using the public airwaves. So I'll end with East Timor and the message we take from East Timor. This place that has known so much suffering in the world, thousands of miles away on the other side of the earth, 1975, the Indonesian military invades Timor with the approval of President Ford and U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, who went and met with the dictator in Indonesia the next day. Indonesian military invades by land, by air, and by sea. 90% of the weapons used were from the United States. Over the next 17 years, they closed the country to the outside world and just carried out one of the great slaughters of the 20th century. In 90 and 91, I got a chance to go there with my colleague Alan Nairn, a great investigative reporter. In 91, November 12, 91, we were at the Santa Cruz Cemetery with thousands of Timorese who were protesting yet another young man killed by the Indonesian military. And we saw the Indonesian soldiers marching up 12 to 15 abreast. We walked to the front of the crowd. We'd always hidden our equipment in the past because anyone caught talking to a Western reporter was seriously in danger, could be arrested or disappeared. But now we put on our headphones, held up our microphone, walked to the front of the crowd to make clear to the soldiers who we were, thinking they would never commit a massacre in front of journalists. Well, 12 to 15 abreast, hundreds of Indonesian soldiers carrying their US M16s at the ready position marched up on this crowd of thousands of Timorese, girls in their Catholic school uniforms, boys in their school shorts, women in their traditional Timorese garb. The soldiers marched up. They swept past us, and without any warning, without any provocation, without any hesitation, they opened fire on the crowd, gunning people down from right to left. They threw me to the ground. Alan threw himself on top of me to protect me from further injury, and they took their US M16s like baseball bats and they slammed them against his skull until they fractured it. They were killing everyone around us. The soldiers lined up in firing squad fashion. They put the guns to our heads and they were screaming two things, politique and Indonesia. Politique, because to witness something like this was political. And they were shouting Australia, asking if we were from Australia. 17 years before, in 75, when Indonesia invaded, there were 6 Australian-based reporters who were covering the invasion. They executed 5 of them immediately. The 6th, Roger East, who was reporting for the world from a radio station in Dili, East Timor, the capital, they dragged out of the radio station as he shouted, "I'm from Australia." They shot him into the harbor. So as we lay on the ground, Alan, covered in blood, we shouted back, "No, we're from America. We're not from Australia." They'd stripped us of everything. After the Australian journalists were killed, the Australian government hardly protested. We believe because years later, Australia and Indonesia signed the Timor Gap Treaty, which divided up Timor's oil between Australia and Indonesia. Oil is the source of so much pain. So as we lay on the ground, soldiers with the guns at our heads, and we shouted, "America, America." Finally, they took the guns from our heads. We believe because we were from the same country their weapons were from. They would have to pay a price for killing us that they never had to pay for killing the Timorese. And they moved on. We were able to get into a Red Cross Jeep. Dozens of Timorese jumped on top of us, jumped on top of the Jeep. And we drove like that as a human mass to the hospital. When we got there, the doctors and nurses started to cry when they saw us. We were not in worse shape than the Timorese. The Indonesian military killed more than 270 Timorese that day. But I think because of what we represent to people around the world, and that's not just us, but people from the United States, and I would include people from Canada. In the United States, we come from the most powerful country on earth, and people know that. I think we represent 2 things, the sword and the shield. The sword, because the U.S. provides so many weapons to so many repressive regimes on earth and also uses them themselves. But the shield, because as the American people, and that includes Canadians as well, we can make such a difference just by little actions that we take. It has a ripple effect all over the world. And on that day, November 12th, 91, they saw that shield bloodied, and it just deepened their despair. Fast forward 10 years, May 20th, 2002, the people of East Timor celebrated their freedom. They celebrated their independence. It was absolutely remarkable. After a third of their population was wiped out, one of the great genocides of the 20th century, proportionally worse than Pol Pot's Cambodia, midnight, May 19th into 20th, 100,000 people at Tasitolo, right outside of Dili, the capital, on a sandy plain. And Alan and I were able to go to witness this and to celebrate with the people of East Timor. Xanana Gusmão, the rebel leader of East Timor, long imprisoned by the U.S.-backed Indonesian military, ascended the stage. As Kofi Annan sat down, this founding president of Timor, Gusmão, unfurled the flag of the Democratic Republic of East Timor. And as the people looked up at the fireworks display, you could see the light reflected in their tear-stained faces. This nation of survivors had prevailed. They had resisted, and they had won. But they knew they couldn't have done it without people of goodwill all over the world. People in Canada, people in the United States, people in Australia, people in Britain who had said no to their governments providing weapons to the brutal Indonesian military. And they also understood and so often talked about the media that was there, the media that cared all through that period and what a difference it made. What a difference it made when there was finally a media spotlight that shone on something important, on matters of life and death. And they have been a model, really taught us all a lot. My God, they paid such an unbelievably high price for their freedom, but they did ultimately win their independence. And the lesson is, no matter what we do or who we are, as journalists, activists, artists, doctors, lawyers, teachers, students, employed or unemployed, We have a decision to make every day, every hour of every day, whether to represent the sword or the shield. Democracy Now.
That was the award-winning Amy Goodman with her lecture at 2004's NCRA Radio Conference. Tuning in. That's it for this episode of Think. Thanks for tuning in. This week's episode of Think was produced and edited by me, Chris Roth, with assistance from CJSR's news director, Matt Hatt. For CJSR, broadcasting on 88.5 FM in Edmonton and at CJSR.com around the world, thank you very much for listening.